You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Anahola, K284AL Halaiva. It's time for In the Garden, On the Farm.
Views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show we will get the rub on the healing powers of a common beachside plant and have an in-depth discussion with UH plant pathologist Dr. Scott Nelson. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our fine sponsors, Harvest Market, Kauai Marine and Mower, Anahola Stringed Instruments, and Edible Hawaiian Islands Magazine.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapaa Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda garden and lawn equipment and also Echo power equipment. 823-0556.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
Edible Hawaiian Islands is a subscription-based, advertiser-supported print and digital magazine, the only James Beard Award-winning food and drink magazine in the state of Hawaii. Edible Hawaiian Islands digital magazine may be enjoyed at ediblehi.com.
Robin!
Aloha, Paul!
It's a beautiful day.
It is indeed.
Loving the birds, the rain, the everything that's going on here on Kauai and in our earlobes and in the listeners' earlobes. We want to thank everybody for supporting us, our underwriters, the board of directors, all the volunteers at KKCR. We are a nonprofit organization, and your tax-free donation really helps us out. So please consider going to kkcr.org and click the donate button at the top of the page. You could also call our office line at 826-7774 if you want to donate time, energy, materials, funds, whatever. We really certainly appreciate it. We want to give a special shout out to people who are listening to us all over the world today and focusing in on good growing. Maybe what we share today will be applicable to all parts of the world, but we're here in the subtropics, and we're going to focus in on a lot of the very specific challenges or opportunities that we have here. So, Robin.
Yes.
I love focusing in on these subjects with you, and I learn something from you each and every time we get together.
Likewise.
So let's get into our celestial session. We look to the heavenly skies above each and every week on the show for inspiration and guidance on our harvesting, planting, tending, and other farming and gardening activities. And we'll look first to the traditional Hawaiian knowledge gained over centuries of careful observation and judging the results with different plants and different phases of the moon. Today's moon phase brought to us by the 2015 Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar, thanks to the Hanalei Watershed Hui and all the great collaborators who worked with them, as well as the U.S. Naval Observatory's Astronomical Applications Department for calculating the precise timing of our moon's movements. Today's Hawaiian moon is Kupau, and this is in the Ho'onui, or rising on a Hulu, the first week in the Hawaiian moon month. Kupau rose over Kauai just shortly ago, 11:46 a.m. She will reach her transit, her highest point in the sky, at 5:48 p.m. this afternoon. She'll set tonight at 11:46 p.m., so up and down in exactly 12 hours. That time does change from day to day, week to week. I don't exactly understand why, but now we have exactly 12 hours of moon. On this particular day, 38% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated today. And the first quarter moon arriving tomorrow at 6:04 p.m. The Mana'o on Kupau, as I said, is in the first of three Anahulu or Hawaiian moon weeks, and it is the fourth of four Ku moons as well in the beginning of the month. Planting recommendations are uala, sweet potato, and kalo, for they shall stand firm and upright, which is one of the definitions of the word ku. Ku, of course, also one of the major gods in the Hawaiian pantheon, a god of war, but also of the flourishing both on land and in the sea. And traditional wisdom says that prayers to ku in the morning facing east could assist in the flourishing of crops.
Wow, that's great fertilizer. Truly.
Good to have the gods on our side.
No doubt about it. Well, in the biodynamic look at things, the moon is in its descending phase, so it is planting time throughout this week. And today and tomorrow with the moon in Virgo, an earth sign, would make it a good time to plant our root plants, which falls in quite nicely with U'ala and Taro both. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty good. We can get busy with that the next 2 days. And then for the weekend, Friday and Saturday, with the moon in Libra, an air sign, making it time to work with our flowering plants, give us another chance to get some of those great pollinator attractant plants, flowering plants, into our garden. And Sunday, Monday, the moon will be in Scorpio, a water sign, making it a good time to plant some leafy plants. So whatever your favorite leafy greens are, it'll be an excellent time for them. Tuesday with the moon in Sagittarius is a fire sign, making it a good time to work with our fruiting plants. And after that, the descending moon phase will be over. It'll be back towards ascending with the energies moving back up into the upper parts of the plant.
So this is a real power week for planting all different kinds of plants in your garden to give you root yield, flower yield, fruit yield, leaf yield.
It's
got
beautiful.
It all.
Everything is represented this week. That's right. It's a gardener's perfect week.
Gardener's paradise.
And an eater's perfect week as well.
Yes. Yum, 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 yum. Well, as we told you at the top of the show, we're really excited for an in-depth discussion with our friend Dr. Scott Nelson. He's with the University of Hawaii, and he does a lot of research on plant diseases. He keeps us abreast and aware and stocked up with options on how to manage some of these challenges or hopefully steer around them. So we're going to get to that later in the hour. But right now we're going to jump into some notable news as well. And this is not exactly sort of the latest news just out, but it sure is news to me. And when we had a visit from David Watmore over at the Food Forest to help us out with the pruning of our fruit trees a couple of weeks ago, we were assessing the health and condition of our various trees. And we were talking in depth about each variety, and one of them was the soursop. And David is a member of the Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers Association, and certainly the membership there are always talking fruit, 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 and all of the knowledge out there. And sadly to say, with soursop, which is considered and revered not only such a delicious fruit, but also as a medicinal plant, which is valuable for fighting different kinds of cancer, both as a folk remedy, and there's also been some laboratory analyses showing the efficacy of the extract of leaves on different kinds of cancer, at least in rats, not humans. It's also been shown that it can cause some brain damage. So that's not good news, because boy, the stuff is in the markets right now. We're really coming into soursop season.
Certainly. There's just tables full of soursops out there.
And they're delicious, and we like to juice them. A lot of people don't like to eat soursop, so I prefer to eat it. I just really like it, but some people don't like that texture, and so it gets juiced. And, of course, when we're juicing, we're concentrating. We're consuming more of the fruit than we would if we were just eating it whole. And it turns out that years ago it was noted that there was an abnormally high rate of atypical Parkinson's recorded in the people of the island of Guadalupe in the Caribbean. And these people were noted as consuming what was described as chronic amounts of soursop. So it's such a productive plant and nutritious, high in vitamin C, vitamins B1 and 2. Definitely good for you, but as we know, all things in moderation. Also shown in Guam, New Caledonia, and other places where people consume a lot, this incidence of a neurological disorder that is either atypical Parkinson's or something close to it. A toxin identified as a member of the class acetogenin is a class of toxins in plants, and the specific toxin is anonycin, was shown to cause brain degeneration in rats. Now, this is the same toxin that makes it useful to kill cancer, but it's also killing brain cells.
Interesting. And anonycin's representative of the Anona family to which it belongs.
Yep.
Does that mean, Paul, that all Anona family relatives have this particular toxin?
I'm not sure it's all, but it was suggested that it's not unique to the soursop and that it is probably found or likely to be found in other members of Anonaceae. And it's concentrated in the fruit, it's in the seeds, as well as a tea made from the leaves, which is how people are using it as a remedy for cancer. According to the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, they describe the negative effect of it as movement disorders and a neuropathy that affects the myelin sheath with symptoms similar to Parkinson's disease. Caused by consumption. It also can cause liver and kidney toxicity, according to their research. So there's still not enough known. Then there was some more research that said they could not conclusively prove that it was actually the soursop that was causing this degenerative illness. But this being the season, I would say it's definitely safer to play it on the safe side and consume less.
Now, small quantities.
Right. And what David Watmore told me was, I think it was 8 fruits in a season of Anona of any kind, and our beloved Rilinia also belonging to that family, too.
Correct.
Cherimoya, there's many revered and loved members of this plant family, and that we really should be limiting our consumption, all things in moderation. I'm sure it's good if you take a little bit, but don't go on
a soursop fast.
Soursop fast, exactly, with your katuk mixed in there, too. As
right.
We know, plenty of tropical plants have these chemicals because it helps to protect the plant from insect or maybe even disease invasion. And, again, we'll be talking to Dr. Scott Nelson about the immune systems of plants and other fascinating things a little bit later in the show.
Yeah, it sounds like we're going to have to use our discipline and not overconsume those moyas. Boy, it's kind of a tough hit. But let's talk about another plant that actually has some really amazing healing properties that is literally right under our very noses and toes.
Indeed, we should. And this is a plant that I couldn't find any deleterious qualities to, not any brain damage or anything like that, but a plant that's merely there to help us out. A plant that is invasive in other parts of the world where it has escaped, but here in Hawaii is a native plant, an indigenous plant, and we are talking about the Naupaka kahakai, which means the Naupaka of the ocean side, and Scaevola sericea or Scaevola toccata. I see both of these names used. Scientists like to decide on one name as the authoritative name, and this is an example of one plant where it seems like the authorities are not in agreement. Here in Hawaii, S. toccata is the species name that's used, but according to the Catalog of Life, which Kew Gardens contributes to, it's the Sericea. But either way, it's in the Gudniaceae family. It's found on all the main Hawaiian islands and the northwest Hawaiian islands. This is a plant that even on a low coral atoll, you're going to find it. And I'm curious, with the time you've spent down in the Tuamotu's, Robin, is now paca a plant that you noticed or recognized?
I have to say I was kind of interested in other things, but I do not recall seeing very much nopaca, but I don't want to say that it wasn't there. I'm just not sure.
This is it could well be, it has escaped now into the Caribbean or other parts where it was not native to, and other members of the Scaevola genus now that are native to that part of the world are threatened by the nopaca because it is such an aggressive plant. It's thought to be the native plant here in the Hawaiian Islands that's maybe used more in landscaping than any other plant, because it's so easy to establish, it can grow right on the shoreline. But we also see this plant growing up into the forest, which is an interesting situation, because Naupaka kuahivi, which is the mountain naupaka, of which there are a number of varieties that are endemic to the Hawaiian Islands, and then Naupaka kahakai, the beach naupaka, there is a couple of versions of stories about how these plants formed their half flowers.
Yes, I was going to say that. I've noticed they each have half flowers.
Yes, and so a story of lovers that were separated, either cast apart from each other from one reason or another, sometimes by their kumuhula, sometimes by other forces that separated these lovers. And so the naupaka of the mountain and the naupaka of the shore, if you gather their flowers and lay them next to each other, it forms a perfect flower rather than a half flower.
Right.
So you'd have to see maybe what I'm talking about, but the petals are only in a half moon shape rather than a full circle.
On each plant, yeah.
On each plant.
It's so interesting. One of the things that I've admired over the years about naupaka is how, depending on the exact little microclimate it's growing in, its habit and the way it looks can be so varied. In very, very windy sides of the island, I see this plant, it's almost laying on the ground, may not even summit over 2 feet tall, versus in a shadier zone or a more protected area where maybe the wind isn't quite so abusive, they can get, 8 feet tall. I've seen them just enormous, and that is both the beach kind, just depending on its climate, and the leaf can be large or smaller and thicker, and there's so many different variations it takes based on the exact place where it's growing. I just admire it for its adaptability,
I have to pause up Robin and Paul and make this announcement again that the island of Kauai is under a flash flood warning until 2:30 this afternoon. At 11:30, about an hour ago, a gauge on the Hanalei River showed a rapid rise in water level from the heavy rain near Hanalei. Heavy rains will likely result in flooding near the Hanalei Bridge and may impact travel along Kuhio Highway. In fact, Hanalei Bridge may close. A flash flood warning means flash flooding is imminent or occurring in streams, roads, and low-lying areas. Do not cross fast-flowing or rising water in your vehicle or on foot. Again, this flash flood watch remains in effect until 2:30. Please be careful out there. We return you to the Garden Show.
And it does adapt to the point where I have found it in forest walks, where I'm up 500 feet elevation on a forested slope or even in a luhe-covered slope,
wow.
And there is naupaka kahakai growing there as if it was a mountain naupaka, maybe looking for its lost lover.
Yes, or perhaps a seed inadvertently dropped by a bird or a hiker.
I would imagine. And there is also a endemic variety, which is a small naupaka. This is the Scaevola coriacea, which is an endemic dwarf beach naupaka, which would be very interesting to grow. It's thought to be extinct on Kauai, but still extant on Molokai and a couple of other places, I think, on Maui as well. But at any rate, getting back to our common plant, this is a great example of a medicinal plant that one of the greatest benefits of it is it's located where you need it, and it is ever-present. And so while there, I was able to crop up a few uses that I had not heard from other parts of Polynesia, Micronesia, leaves and young fruit used to treat heartburn and indigestion, diarrhea even, the fruits used to make an eye drop for itchy eyes, the roots as an antidote for fish or crab poisoning, to treat beriberi, dysentery, and syphilis, the use in Hawaii, as it was taught through the tradition of Kumu Lavan Ohai, who's taught many of us here, is to use it topically to treat wounds, and even specifically if you get a rash from getting dragged on the reef from a bad wave or something like that, but even cuts, that it's very effective for healing those.
Reef cuts.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, so how ideal. You've come out of the water, you're bleeding, you can walk right over to the plant. And did he describe the exact way that...
Well, he did, and I want to give thanks to Felicia Cowden, a fellow programmer here at KKCR, who has reminded me of the use of this plant, not because she took the class with Ohai more recently than I did, but because it's something that she actually picked up, has practiced, and has taught to her own students to use this plant. And the easy thing to do is you grab the leaf. This is as taught by Ohai. You grab the leaf, you chew it up if you're right there at the beach, and you apply that ground-up paste or the macerated paste onto your wound. And Felicia likes to actually top that up, if she has access to it, with a noni leaf that she's heated over a fire, or you can use you could stick it in a frying pan or stick it over your propane stove flame to heat it up, and then put a Band-Aid on top of that. And she remarks at the tremendously fast healing properties, and that it leaves... It seals it right up, the wound. It's antibiotic, which was shown actually in laboratory tests as the antibiotic qualities of it as well, but the superb wound healing qualities too. And it's something that when you use a medicinal plant, it shows its power to you, that you remember it, you keep going back and using it. I have to admit, I don't spend a whole lot of time at the beach, and I think that's probably why I never picked up the use of this. But it certainly is good to know, because it's easy enough to get wounded down at the beach, barefoot, maybe a sharp rock tears your foot open, or you get a reef cut or something else. It sure is handy to have this plant on your side.
Sure. Well, that's very timely information, because in the summertime we do tend to spend more time down by the seashore and foraging around and whatnot, with the ocean being a little calmer in the summer. And so now all of our listeners know that if they get a cut from the reef, they just need not look no further than the naupaka on the beach. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. So much thanks to the beautiful native healing plants and the traditions that have been passed down. We're so grateful here in Hawaii. We have such an Akamai host culture that has so many deep traditions that we can learn from and perpetuate through our own use.
Indeed.
This is In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts Paul and Robin. We're here until 1 o'clock, and we encourage you to stay tuned for all sorts of great programming throughout the day and throughout the week. You can see the program schedule by going to the kkcr.org website. And if you listen regularly on Wednesdays but you don't tune in other days, get adventurous. Check out some of the other great programming and keep it dialed right here on KKCR. Well, Robin, it's time to get into our feature for the show today. Very excited. We're going to talk about plant disease management. with specific management suggestions. And we're joined once again by our friend, Dr. Scott Nelson. Scott is a specialist at UH Manoa's Department of Plant and Environmental Protection Sciences. He has master's and PhD degrees in plant pathology. Scott specializes in epidemiology and extension education, teaches courses on genetics, plant pest diagnosis, and plant disease management, and he's authored a multitude of informative publications through the College of Tropical Agriculture and with Pacific Island Agroforestry, probably more. Like us, Scott is a true plant nut with interests and projects spanning the spectrum of human-plant interaction, including grafting, medicinal plants and tropical fruits, and mitigation of damage to crops caused by volcanic emissions, just to name a few. And Scott, we're really glad you took the time once again to join us on the show.
Well, thank you, Paul and Robin. It's my pleasure once again to be on your garden show.
Fantastic. Well, we are harking back to months ago when you've joined us, and we've got a little more time to talk to you this time around. So I wanted to start out by asking, with such an interesting career, how was it that you decided this was going to be your life's work?
Well, that is a good question. It's basically, it boils down to following in my father's footsteps, because, you know, he worked as a plant pathologist in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s at North Carolina State University and at Penn State University.
Oh, wow. And so he was keeping an eye on you and hoping you would follow in his footsteps, or do you think he never would have guessed that you'd follow him?
He never would have guessed, because I got a bachelor's degree in European history, and then I went to work in the oil fields of Texas, and working as a drilling fluids engineer and also as a mud logger, which is a well site geologist. And that was in the early 1980s, and the market for oil crashed. And then I started looking around, well, what am I going to do, you know, with my life? And so I took a road trip up to Seattle and Portland, and I visited with a friend who I knew in high school. And I saw that he was doing experiments with fish. And I remember at that moment, the light went on in my head, and I said, you know, I want to go back to school. But, you know, when I went back to school, I was going to get a Bachelor of Science in Agronomy at Texas A&M University to be a golf course superintendent. And so I was almost finished with that degree. I needed a few more credits, and I had to take a plant pathology course. And then when I took that course, you know, of course, I'd been exposed to plant pathology since around 1960, when I would visit my father's lab. And, you know, I'd worked for my father's program in the 1970s as a, you know, research lab assistant. But anyway, when I took that plant pathology course at Texas A&M, I think it was 1985, I fell in love with it and, you know, dropped out of the Bachelor of Science degree in agronomy and moved over to a Master of Science degree in plant pathology. And that was it.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Was there a particular bug or pathogen that really caught your interest?
Yes, for the master's degree, I was working under a plant nematologist. So a nematode is a microscopic worm that's just a roundworm that infects the roots of plants. In this case, it was the root knot nematode that attacks peanut. Mm. It was called Meloidogyne arenaria. So I was worked on a project that examined wild species of peanuts collected from Brazil and South America, screening them for resistance to this pest.
Cool. Were you able to do some field research and get down there as part of your master's thesis?
No, but one of the advisors on my committee had been going to Brazil frequently for about a dozen years before I met him, and he did all the collecting of these wild species from the Brazilian Shield area, which is kind of an uplifted, you know, geographic area in the rainforests of central Brazil. Wow. So he's walked through the forests and talked to the people, finding these wild species, which many of them were tetraploid. In other words, had four copies of the chromosomes, whereas the commercial peanut grown in the United States is a diploid. So they, we had to do some chromosome doubling to make the breeding program work to incorporate those resistant genotypes that we found in the project that I did. Wow. So we found some peanuts that were resistant to the root knot nematodes, and the breeding program, which took about, I think about 12 years, finally introgressed those genes into the commercial variety.
Through traditional breeding practices.
Right, through traditional breeding. And we found a couple of different genes or different types of resistance. I think both of them were, moved into the commercial peanuts. And so that is a really a good form of disease management for plant diseases, is to use resistant host material if it's been developed or discovered. Mm. Yeah.
Or if it hasn't, to just go ahead and develop it yourself, it sounds like.
Well, you can. With traditional breeding, it can take, a decade or longer to make that work, because usually the resistant material they're found in wild species that are usually at the center of origin for that plant species on the globe. So at these centers of origin, which are called epicenters for these plants, you have a wider, gene pool, and you have the coevolution of the host and the pathogen for the longest period of time, which could be, many, many thousands or longer of years. And so when you get this coevolution between the host and the pathogen, you get the greater probability of the development of resistance genes in the host species. And many of them are not, grown commercially. And in fact, when, crops are developed for commercial use, or were developed, a lot of these resistance genes were lost in the breeding process that were, the breeders were selecting for, yield, or maybe some major genes of resistance. And, in that process, a lot of the more useful genes that contribute minor effects, in a cumulative way can really help you, but they're lost in the traditional breeding programs.
Is it would it be true that that's compounded by if it's in a conventional system where pesticides and herbicides are just standardly applied even before something is detected, just as a matter of regular management, that plants that don't have the resistance themselves are not preferred in the system, basically?
Well, that's correct. In the traditional modern cropping systems, a lot of pesticides are used, and you might not notice some genotypes that can be of benefit in those circumstances that can give you disease resistance, because you're not really seeing the expression of that. But, in a breeding program, the breeders are exposing these genotypes to the pathogen. They want to see the expression of the genes. So usually there's no really management of the pathogen or the pests in those breeding programs.
Mm-hmm.
They want to see the expression of resistance. But, there's different types of resistance if you're looking at it from a management perspective. You have single or major gene type of resistance where you can normally get, great effects against the pathogen. Then you have more or less multiple gene or minor genes in accumulation in a plant that also give you resistance, but it's not as major. You don't see the dramatic expression of it in the field. And the problem with the major gene resistance is that pathogens can evolve through mutation or sexual recombination to overcome these major genes, and that's normally what happens in these types of crops, such as wheat, that are bred for resistance to a race of a rust fungus. They're overcome easily. So if you're looking from a management perspective, it's much more durable to have a combination of minor genes in the host, but the problem is trying to identify those because they're usually masked by the presence of these major genes, because the major genes have a dramatic expression. It may be hypersensitivity or some type of effect that can easily be overcome by the pathogen, most pathogen populations. So when you're breeding and you see these major effects, you're going to select those to move along in your breeding program because they're so dramatic. And in that process, a lot of these minor genes drop out of the gene pool, so you lose them. But, you know, so that's the real challenge in today's breeding for disease resistance, is how do you, you know, pyramid, you know, these, how do you create these genetic pyramids out of these minor genes to give you really something that's stable and durable over a long period of time?
We want to let people know, if you just tuned in, we're speaking with Dr. Scott Nelson. He's a plant pathologist at the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture. And I want to follow up on that, but Robin, you had a question.
Well, so I wanted to ask you, Doc, is that what's known as horizontal resistance? When we talk, what you're talking about, the pyramid version, instead of just the genes that are expressing loudly, that you want to keep all those other lower expression genes too, is that what's known as horizontal resistance?
Yes, that's another term. You know, horizontal resistance is the type of resistance that gives you an effect against all or most genotypes in the pathogen population. Mm-hmm. Now, so you're not specifically targeting a race or a certain pathotype, but yeah, the horizontal resistance is a broadly based resistance against the entire pathogen population, and it's usually the effect of many genes instead of a single gene.
Well, I heard you say before that it's easier said than done. We're doing a trial grow out of different kinds of vegetable seed crops here on Kauai this summer, and so maybe it's too hard to say, but how would you then recommend that we do our selection process in the field to promote the minor genes rather than getting sucked into the major gene selection?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is observe carefully, you know, the plants. Okay, you might see some major gene resistance, and it might be durable. Okay, so, right, you want to move some of those through, but pay attention to the response of the crops to the diseases. Now, you may get acceptable levels of yield, especially if you're in an organic farming situation, you can accept some blemish. So look for those crops that perform well enough to give you something. You know, you might see the lesions are smaller, for example, than in the really susceptible types. But in the highly resistant ones, you probably won't see any lesions. So, you know, lesion size is one of those things you want to look at. Also, you know, how many spores are being produced? I mean, in some of these horizontal resistance types of hosts, you get fewer spores produced per unit lesion area, which really slows down the rate of the epidemic over time. I mean, you're still going to get some disease, but the epidemic itself over cycles of, you know, lesions and spore production in that season will be fewer. Therefore, you'll suffer less overall disease severity on that crop.
So we're talking very careful observation here. This isn't just scanning, yeah, a brief scan over the crop, but it's...
Going to interrupt the In the Garden on the Farm to remind you that there is a flash flood warning for the island of Kauai until 2:30 this afternoon. A gauge on the Hanalei River showed a rapid rise in water level, which means that Hanalei Bridge could close. We haven't gotten any reports of it closing yet, but it could close. And let's see, the heavy rains will likely result in flooding near the Hanalei Bridge and may impact travel along Kuhio Highway. Flash flood warning means flash flooding is imminent or occurring in streams, roads, and low-lying areas. Do not cross fast-flowing or rising water in your vehicle or on foot. This flash flood warning remains in effect until 2:30 this afternoon. Stay tuned to KKCR. Back to the Garden Show.
Really doing more of a scientific analysis, really.
Well, I would say this: it's really important for the crops in the tropics here that have not really been improved, you know, by professional breeders. So we have the opportunity to try to get some of this durable type of resistance into these crops. It could be taro. It could be other crops grown locally that haven't really been improved. Anonia is one of these crops, you know, that has never been any breeding done, maybe some selections done by the Polynesians or the, I doubt by the Hawaiians, but the people who came to Hawaii brought, you know, a nice variety, and there's other varieties around, but, you know, throughout the Pacific, there are so much variation in the genetics for noni that, you know, for this and other types of crops and breadfruit, for example, although it's more difficult to do breeding for a tree crop, you know, we have the opportunity to not fall into this trap of, you know, selecting crops that have these single genes that, you know, once they're selected and you start planting them in monocrops, you're going to get, you know, the pathogen population changing and then adapting to this gene and then finally defeating that gene that's giving you such good results. You know, which, you know, leads me into the point of, you know, diversity in your cropping system as one way to preserve your genes. Hmm. Like if you have a single gene or a type of resistance that's vulnerable to being overcome by the pathogen, then you want to use a polycropping or agroforestry. You want diversity in your planting system, which will, you know, prevent the rapid buildup of these highly virulent pathogens. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the problems with monocropping, is that, you know, every spore that's produced will land on a susceptible host, or will land on a host. Whereas if you have a polycropping system, a spore produced on your tomato might land on a papaya, but has no chance of infecting that plant. So just the physical barrier introduced by multiple different types of plant species in one spot can help you a lot.
Well, that sure makes a lot of sense. And I know it's tough when people are trying to bring enough crop to market to substantiate or to guarantee shipment to the retailer. Having small diversified farms can be a challenge in terms of marketing the yield, but certainly is a very good integrated disease management strategy. And that is something that we've been covering all month, is really thinking about this integrated pest or disease management, weed management. And when you're explaining what that means, I'm curious to know, what's your definition of integrated disease management, and what are the steps along the way of consideration?
Okay, thank you, Paul. Well, that's a very good question. Actually, I look at it from several different perspectives as far as the integration goes. I mean, the first thing is, you know, when you talk about integration, you're really trying to attack the problem from several different angles simultaneously, is the way I look at it. So, for example, you have a disease. Now, the only way you can have a disease occurring in a location is you have to have, first of all, a conducive environment for that pathogen to infect the host. Secondly, you have to have a susceptible host present. And then thirdly, you have to have a virulent pathogen present. So this is called the disease triangle. And so one way to integrate disease management is to attack several vertices of this triangle simultaneously. And this can be applied to any cropping system or any pathosystem you want to describe. Okay, so you have a susceptible host. Well, let's introduce a resistant host, and that will help to control the disease, maybe completely. Or let's say that you have a conducive environment. What can you do to modify that environment to make it less conducive for infection? For example, you have a nursery. You have a lot of fungal leaf spots of the plants, but you're using sprinkler irrigation. I mean, you're creating wet leaves, which makes it easy for the pathogen to infect. If you change to a drip irrigation system, you've modified the environment of those leaves. That makes it less conducive for the leaf spot disease to occur. So it's just common sense. Or you might want to improve the drainage in your field if you have a root rot problem. You're modifying the environment. Or you may want to reduce the relative humidity in the plant canopy. And you can do that by pruning or by modifying your irrigation schedule or by plant spacing. You know, and then you have the pathogen. I mean, you can attack the pathogen. If you're growing organically, you can use sanitation to remove heavily diseased leaves from the plant and get rid of them, or you can use organically approved pesticides to spray on the pathogen, to kill the pathogen. Mm-hmm. So all I'm saying is that one way to look at integrated disease management is to integrate practices that attack several vertices, the three vertices of the disease triangle, the host, the pathogen, and the environment.
That's a great way to think about it, and it's got the wheels turning in my mind. And one of the challenges we have in our particular location where our farm is located is we do have high rainfall. We do have high humidity, and it seems like it does breed a host of disease organisms because of that situation. When I'm thinking about, so we regularly talk about how can we alter the immediate environment in which the crop is growing, and especially as we're considering growing seeds that are dried hyson seeds that have to mature on the plant, ideally, and come to a dry situation before they are harvested. This is a real challenge for us. It's a challenge we're up to, but what I'm wondering is, in specific to this, if we're growing seeds in an environment where they are particularly perhaps susceptible to disease occurrence because of our high humidity, high rainfall, then, and yet the seeds we're producing will be used in areas that perhaps do not receive as much rainfall, are we creating seeds that perhaps are not resistant to conditions that would show up in a drier environment? What is the applicability of our seeds better because they're more resistant to the diseases in general, or are they not well adapted to a lower rainfall area?
Well, I mean, are these cross-pollinated seeds you're producing?
Cross or selfing, depending on the variety. I mean,
okay.
It could be a self-pollinating bean, or it could be a cross-pollinating eggplant, for instance.
Personally, I don't think there's much concern for the use of those seeds in a drier place. But I think the concern about the relative humidity is a valid one. And so the question becomes, what can you do practically to modify that? And so, first of all, one of the things that creates a lot of humidity in a plant canopy are weeds. So if you have like grassy or any types of weeds in these plots, you should keep them cut down or covered with mulch or something to, you know, they're transpiring. And transpiration is that movement of the water from the soil up through the roots, up through the vascular system, and out the leaves as water vapor.
Yes.
Because the sun is pulling that water up and out.
Yes, our kapuna, who's been here for his family for generations, who's been taking rainfall measurements for decades, says that he thinks that the rain has dropped by as much as 20 inches a year because previously the land was completely covered in sugarcane and there was so much evapotranspiration from the leaf that there was that much more rainfall even.
You know, I believe that. We see the same effect in the Federated States of Micronesia. There's some islands there. You know, Ponape is one of them, who's also, you know, as the rainforest is being cleared gradually, they're altering the climate. So we know that. And so I believe what the Kupuna says. And now when you're growing your seed crops, they're growing in rows?
Yes.
Okay. Are the rows, now, is there a slope to the land?
Fairly level.
Okay. So one of the things that the banana farmers do, at least on the Big Island, is they have rows of plants. And the rows are, they, when it's possible and there's no significant slope to the land, they orient the rows in the direction of the prevailing trade winds, so that the trade winds can dry off. The trade winds are moving down the rows, in other words, not across the rows. So as the trade winds move down through the rows, it dries off the canopy more rapidly after rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Now, also drainage of the soil, if it's a problem, you know, the water vapor can, if it's a soggy soil, can come up out of the soggy soil and create humid conditions for fungi to infect leaves. So, you know, is that a problem at your place where you're growing seeds?
I would imagine, yes.
Okay, so then it might be a good idea to, if you can, dig some drainage ditches at the edge of the field, maybe plant on raised beds, something to improve the drainage of your field. Maybe adding organic matter to the soil if it's a really heavy soil, which it might be. If it's a high clay soil, you know, adding organic matter or some other things to the soil to improve the structure of the soil can help it drain better and not stay wet so long.
Great advice. I just want to let our listeners know we're listening. We're talking to Dr. Scott Nelson from University of Hawaii. We're so grateful. You know, before we run out of time here, Doc, I really wanted to talk to you about bananas and particularly bunchy top. Again, I know we've discussed this before, but in my observations, it seems like things are getting worse on that front on Kauai. It seems to be spreading ever more rapidly, and I couldn't help but wonder when we were talking about horizontal disease resistance, and since you seem to be really up on the banana diseases, I wondered if there's any progress being made as far as, you know, breeding bananas that could be resistant to this, or, I mean, we used to sort of just let our banana patches go, and they, you know, cut up the trunks, throw them in there, and everything was fine. But it's that kind of management, benign neglect management, as I call it, just doesn't seem to be working anymore. They're falling like dominoes, our banana mm-hmm. patches around here. And I wondered if you have any update on bunchy top and any kind of research that might be going on.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Robin. Well, I served as a committee member for a graduate student. His name was Gabriel Sachter Smith. Some of you may have be familiar with his name. He just finished his master's program here at the university.
Wow.
And what he was doing, he collected, I would say, maybe, you know, 50 or 60 different more or less exotic bananas and in his collection, and we planted them at Waimanalo Experiment Station on this island.
I saw that planting years ago.
We're going to pause this program for a moment, again, to remind you that Kauai is under a flash flood warning until 2:30 this afternoon. Also to announce the Hanalei Bridge has closed. The Hanalei Bridge has closed. They will keep us informed as to when it is going to reopen. For the moment, we need to report the Hanalei Bridge has closed. Flash flood warning will remain in effect until 2:30 this afternoon. Flash flood warning means flash flooding is imminent or occurring in streams, roads, and low-lying areas. Don't cross fast-flowing or rising water in your vehicle or on foot. Turn around. Be careful out there. Ponding on the roads as well, so please slow it down a little bit. Be careful. And flash flood warning will remain in effect until 2:30 this afternoon, may be extended depending upon the weather conditions And again, the Hanalei Bridge has closed. Tracy and Kauai Vibrations will be coming up in just a few minutes. We've had to extend the In the Garden on the Farm today because of these warnings.
Or was it more recent?
Well, probably several years ago he started planting it.
Yes.
So then for a couple of years he monitored it, you know, specifically for a bungee top robin. And it was a design that had, you know, the varieties randomly placed in a grid-like pattern in the field. And so one of the things he was looking at was, you know, the expression of symptoms and when the symptoms were expressed. And then he did a greenhouse experiment where he inoculated the plants using viruliferous aphids, you know, aphids who have picked up the virus. These are banana aphids through their feeding. And then he transferred these banana aphids to the plants to observe symptom expression. The bottom line is, according to Gabe, there are some interesting bananas in that group that seem to possibly have what we refer to as this horizontal type of resistance.
Excellent.
You know, where they have a slower expression of symptoms and the symptoms are not as severe. So I think the experiment should be repeated to really make that conclusion, but Gabe is excited about it.
Well, that is just excellent news. Even anything in that direction makes me feel happier. Bananas being one of our, you know, staple crops here. I checked out the Plant Diseases in Hawaii website, and gosh, there's just so many, and so many of them affect plants that we live off of, basically.
Yeah. Well, yeah, some of the, with the banana bungee top, one of the problems, a couple of problems I see is the first of all that the state of Hawaii has really ramped down their aggressive approach to managing it. And so that's because, you know, a lot of people lost their jobs in the Hawaii Department of Agriculture a few years ago. They didn't have as many inspectors to run around and, you know, identify and eradicate diseased plants. So that the statewide effort from the Hawaii Department of Agriculture's standpoint is not as intensive. And then we have homeowners who do nothing about their – so you have a person with a yard, banana plants sitting there with a virus, you know, it could be for months or a year or more, and they're just kicking out, you know, viruliferous aphids to their neighbors who then find it hard to grow their plants in the vicinity of these infected plants. And then we have the gulches where maybe some wild bananas are growing and maybe they have the disease. No one can even access them. So, I mean, it's impossible at this point to eradicate the disease. So we have to work together as neighbors to, you know, eradicate these plants as soon as they're seen with the symptoms.
Right.
And that's, you know, on Oahu here, you know, there are several locations here on the Manoa campus where we have diseased plants. So even here at the university, plants with bungee top and, you know, are here. And throughout the Manoa Valley, in the residences, you can see it as you drive down the streets. So one of the problems is that I've found is that even with all of the education we've given about the disease over the years and all the publications and lectures and videos, people still don't recognize it, the average person. Mm. So as a farmer, the source of the problem is really from the average person is trying to grow bananas in their yard. Okay. They don't recognize it.
Right. So this leads me to a question about plants in general and their immune systems. We so often recognize the relationship between plants and humans in terms of nutrition. We both need the same minerals and nutrients. And I'm curious, with an example like the banana bungee top, and then you think about humans, there's plenty of viruses that humans can have that can be quite devastating, yet if the health of the human is strong, the virus can go into remission and not really affect the overall health of the human. Would that be true also of plants, and is there a way to boost the immune system of plants, so even if they have a virus, it doesn't take them down.
Well, Paul, with virus diseases of plants, that's absolutely not true. And that's one of the misconceptions that really makes the process of disease management much more difficult, because you can definitely mask the symptoms of a virus disease by using fertilizer. But the reality is that you're going to have more and more virus particles in that plant than you would have had otherwise. So that as far as the spread of the virus goes to other plants, you're not doing anything to stop it. You may get a little better production by fertilizing on that plant. Maybe it's a papaya plant, but you're not hurting the virus at all. And there's no remission of the virus in the plant. So one of the misconceptions that the papaya industry had on the Big Island in the 1990s was that, you know, you throw fertilizer and the plant comes green again. So that's what they were doing. Instead of eradicating plants with papaya ring spot virus, the industry leaders decided to advise their farmers to use fertilizer because the plants do come green again. But the overall effect was sort of devastating to the epidemic. Mm. Now, with fungal diseases caused by Cercospora, an example could be Cercospora leaf spot of coffee. This is a fungal genus. It causes Cercospora leaf spot and berry blotch of coffee. That disease can be managed with fertilizer. In fact, and plants that have high nutrition and not under stress are fairly resistant to the disease. But the plants that are undernourished, you'll see a lot of Cercospora leaf spot on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Scott Nelson, once again, we realize that an hour is far too short and we've run out of time. We need to connect with you again. It's always so great speaking with you, and we have so much to learn. And obviously, people have great opportunities to learn from your work besides when you join us on the show. So I want to have you put out a couple of contact information. I know you have a great website, HawaiianPlantDisease.net, which is full of information. Any other contact information or links that you'd like to share with people?
Well, the main thing is if people have my email address, snelson@hawaii.edu. So anyone who's listening is welcome to contact me, maybe send me photographs of their sick plants and ask for my diagnosis and recommendations. I'll be glad to respond to them.
Thank you so much. We hope to talk to you soon.
Okay, Paul. Goodbye, Robin.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure. Have a great day.
Okay, thank you.
Aloha. This has been In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Paul and Robin. We'd like to thank our special guest on the show today, Dr. Scott Nelson. You can reach him at snelson@hawaii.edu or go to his website, hawaiiplantdisease.net. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. Aloha.
Aloha.